I'm Michael Krasny, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Gray Matter with Michael Krasny, a weekly podcast of deep dive interviews with national and international authors, journalists, tech and business experts, artists, scientists, entertainers, and opinion shapers. And you can become a member of this podcast simply by going to graymatter.show, and that's gray with an E, and you can stream us. We're live at 11 a.m. Pacific time on Fridays when we include your questions and comments. This week and next week, you'll hear us pre-recorded, but we will be back to our regular non-pre-record, and you can see us as well a couple weeks from now. We cover a wide range of intellectually engaging and timely, stimulating topics, distinguished by high-level content and technical excellence. In this episode, we're going to talk with veteran journalist, editor, and author of a best-selling book called Buddha or Bust, Perry Garfinkel, whose most recent book is Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment Living the Mahatma's Six Moral Truths in Immoral Times. Gandhi, who led the struggle, of course, for India's independence from Britain, was born on October the 2nd, and the United Nations has designated that day worldwide as an international day of nonviolence, which long has and will always be identified with Gandhi and his work and his life. Perry Garfinkel's writings have appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, and National Geographic. He spent 3 years seriously studying Gandhi, and Gandhi also is, of course, called the Mahatma, which means the great soul. And we welcome Perry Garfinkel to Gray Matter with Michael Krasny.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
You know, I was thinking about Gandhi just yesterday, and the impression that I have, and probably that remains in many people's minds, is from the Attenborough film, which won a number of Oscars, including Ben Kingsley, for his performance of Gandhi. And I remember a really good line, and it sort of pertains in some ways to your book. But it was a film critic who said, all these people in Hollywood want to be like Gandhi. They want to be thin, tan, and moral. And to some extent, that reverberates a bit when I think, hey, you wanted to be moral, didn't you?
Yes, yeah. I think that's a driving force. I looked around and saw that seems like the world has lost its moral compass, and I was among them. Yes.
You lost yours as well. You felt lost.
I just felt like I was sinking and moving in the wrong direction. And each time I had a fall or a setback emotionally, professionally, romantically, I defaulted to the bad guy.
But you had done a book on Buddha. You sort of moved from Buddha to Gandhi, or how does this work?
I'll tell you how this happened. I had an agent who actually is from Marin County, Candace Furman. And after
I knew Candace, yeah.
Candace, I thought you knew her. And she had scored my last book, Buddha or Bust, which was a national bestseller. And she said, why not Gandhi now? She was imagining me writing books about, you know, people, legacy people. And at the time, Barack Obama was running for president on a theme that echoes Gandhi's, one of most Gandhi's famous lines was, be the change you want to see in the world. And I said, okay, there might be a large audience of at least young African Americans who had no idea who this little guy with the big ears and the funny John Lennon glasses was. And I dived in and took a look at it. It took 5 or 6, 7 years for me to find a different agent in India who got me a contract there, and her co-agent in New York scored me a deal with Sounds True. It resonated with me because I thought we need somebody with some moral fiber, because the politicians and the other leaders we see in the world today are bereft of that.
Well, Gandhi certainly had an abundance of it, and you know, he continues to inspire people not only in India but all over the world, as you point out in your book. And mm-hmm. I'm also struck by becoming Gandhi. I mean, in a sense, you wanted to maybe identify with him or internalize him, or as opposed to being Gandhi, you know, the ontological. I used to make that existential separation between
yes.
becoming and being. You wanted to become Gandhi?
So in the beginning, the title of the book was Being Gandhi. And not far into the research and reading extensively about him and his life before his philosophy, I thought there's no way I can be Gandhi. So I resorted to the gerundial form, which means becoming is an endless infinity pool where the daily practice is to try to become Gandhi.
Never ends.
It's never ending.
Except with death, I guess.
Well, yeah. Taxes? No. But that's the origins of the title. And you're right that it's It's a practice, and I think there's an old Zen saying, to borrow from my Buddhist experience, if you see the Buddha in the road, kill him. Which means to me, if you think you've attained enlightenment or Buddhahood, just in thinking that, you haven't. And I think it's the same with Gandhi. If you think you're Mr. Perfection, Mr. Moral Integrity, you probably are thinking thoughts that are not so morally, righteous.
Well, the moral integrity for you seemed to boil down to six truths or six principles, which easily could have been seen as 11, I suppose, depending on the nature of religiosity or devotion. But let's look at these for a moment, just so people understand what we're talking about. We're talking about truth as one of those, but also faith. The nonviolence, which, as I said, has always been singularly identified with Gandhi, simplicity, vegetarianism, celibacy, get into some rougher, higher bars here. What did I leave out here?
That's it. That's the six.
I covered them. Good. So these six, and they're all kind of synergistic, right? They all operate.
They're interrelated,
Interrelated and so forth. Those are all high bars.
Yes. The one that people raise their eyebrows about is celibacy, which in Hindi is brahmacharya. Even my editor, as we went through the first draft, she said, well, how—
You're not raising other things in addition to eyebrows when you go that route, I'm
Michael.
Sorry to say.
Her point was well taken. Like, how can abstaining from sex improve your moral compass? And I took a deep dive personally into that, and I thought, well, she's right. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are, you know, a righteous person, a moral person. Some religions abstain. You know, the priests from the Catholic priests are supposed to be asexual. In Judaism, it's actually a mitzvah to procreate. So I myself had not been involved with someone, so it was not a difficult task to be celibate.
Wait a minute, you had a one-night stand that really was empty and kind of put you in the celibacy mood of sorts, didn't it?
Thank you.
Despite the hips that gyrated that you write about vividly. This is in Nicaragua, no less. Colombia.
Colombia, yeah. Cartagena. That was the last sex I think I had before the book was published. But I introspect, and a lot of this book is what happens inside, not outside. And I began to look at the ways, A, that I promoted sexual desire in myself, and also the way society bombards us with images of sexuality that, again, feed our, what the Indians would call our lower chakra.
Our libidos.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know if that's lower chakra.
That is.
It's not synonymous.
It's way down there.
But on the other hand, and let me just, I'll be not necessarily the devil's, but maybe the angel's advocate here. Gandhi was known to prove to himself that he could resist desire, but sounds like Elvis lying next to teenage girls who were somewhat unclothed, and he would see if he could avoid, well, just overwhelm main feeling of wanting them. Also, I found an old quote of Gandhi's that really gave me pause. He said, if you have to choose between cowardice and violence, I'll take violence. So I thought,
I don't recall that.
Yeah,
quote.
No, I mean, some of these things, Gandhi was human, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, when people are human, when they say, I'm going to be celibate or I'm going to be a vegetarian. I've wanted to be a vegetarian for years because I believe, you know, in the principle of saving the planet and all the environmental damage that's done. And I've done interviews with Michael Pollan, and you know, he's convinced me of my health and vegetarian. Can't do it or won't do it. I don't know. It's maybe a combination of the two. Do you become more moral if you go through that self-abnegation?
Well, let's go back to the Gandhi, what you mentioned about Gandhi and sleeping next to teenage girls, and then we'll get into the meatier matters. He sired five kids, so he was not celibate his whole life.
Oh, he's married at 13, wasn't he?
Yes, his wife was 12.
You were bar mitzvahed at 13. He was married already, yeah. Right?
Same difference, I think. 13 in India, that's not uncommon, especially then. As I analyze in my book, I think he had a lot of sex problems. He was kind of hung up. But it was by the age of 60, after his wife had passed away, that he did this experiment to sleep next to two teenage girls. I think they were his nieces. And it's been written about, and they even wrote about it, and he copped to it. To me, it was a flaw. The subtitle of my book is My Experiment, because his book was called My Experiments with Truth. But this experiment of sleeping next to teenagers was flawed because I don't think he understood that the heart is connected to the penis and that, sexual desire should, in a pure world, come from,
this great soul, this brilliant man didn't understand that?
I think he didn't understand that. He grew up in India. India, I feel, has some suppressed sexuality.
Yeah, look at all the rape that's been going on there.
That's
awful.
That's
catastrophic.
Yeah, and so, the several criticisms of him come among them that I hope we'll talk about is that one. And I wrote it off as, really a stupid idea of his that didn't prove anything to him or the rest of the world. And Gandhi was a great marketeer. He was really, a social media influencer long before it ever came to pass. But he messed up on this one, and it proved nothing.
He maybe also didn't understand something that I think is maybe in the nature of a lot of the human animal, and that is aggression. To be nonviolent, you can go out in your car and drive, and somebody cut you off, and then give you the finger, and suddenly there's this atavistic welling up in you. You want to go chase after him.
Road rage is what you're talking about.
Yeah. You write about it. And it's real to people, and they understand it. And understand it on a daily level. If somebody tries to harm them or, is gratuitously nasty to them and rude and so forth, it wells up with feelings of violence. And did he really understand that? When he was talking about truth, for example, as one of those six. I'm thinking of two more, but we won't. There's really 11, like you said.
Right.
Was he really factoring in just the propensity or the tropism that we have to violence and aggression?
I believe he was what we would call a Pollyanna-ish. Like he had a hope in the goodness of man. But one of the most chilling interviews I did for this book was with his grandson, Arun Gandhi, who had been a journalist for the Times of India for 30 years. And when I interviewed him, he was in Rochester, New York. He passed away, sadly, about 2 years ago. He said, violence is in the nature of man. We're not going to avoid violence. And this connected with me, with my understanding of Buddhism, how the two overlap, because people think of Buddha nature, as they call it, as you're all goodness and levitating and you're, pure being. But the Buddha himself saw the human mind in a 360-degree way. So our bad side is part and parcel of our whole body. So the Buddha's approach was a guide to goodness, like how to be happy, how to divert your mind, and neuroplasticity is doing a lot to corroborate this. You can move your mind towards a path that will lead to, let's call it goodness.
Or change, as you write about it.
Change, plasticity. Gandhi was not so sophisticated in that way. And in a lot of ways, I do think he had this idea that everything would work out for the good. Partition proved, when India became independent, the Hindus and the Muslims fought on, and they're still fighting. And one of the points of my book, why I traveled the world, I went to India, where he was born, and traveled his course. I did the Salt March, which is famous and made famous in the Attenborough film. I went to South Africa, where a lot of people forget that he spent 20-odd years.
Practiced law there, in fact.
He was brought there by a Muslim entrepreneur to work out some business deal, and And then I went to UK, where Gandhi went to school in law school in London. But my point was, I wanted to see if Gandhi's message had changed the places where he had been. And in a lot of ways, I was disappointed that it had not. South Africa, for instance.
And yet in India, he's still the father of the nation. You see his face on every rupee, and, you know, he is ubiquitous and is still elevated to a status that's iconic and even beyond iconic. What do you think Gandhi would have thought about Modi, by the way? And it's a little digression, but...
No, it was just on my mind. Modi, let me separate this. Modi uses Gandhi as a political football. Modi is from Gujarat, the state where Gandhi was born. He's considered, you know, Gujarat's own son. And I went to places in Gujarat where my host and heritage management expert showed me that some of the infrastructure, the roads, the garbage had not been taken care of because Modi was withholding funding from these villages because it was Muslims were living there. So this rift persists, and I think Gandhi...
Well, now Gandhi saw things. We were all one religion in his mind, even though he was Hindu, wasn't it?
He was Hindu, and, you know, a lot of Muslims still feel that he screwed them over. There are Sikhs not far from us in the Davis area of California who desecrated Gandhi's statue a few years ago. I went to try to talk to them, and they refused to talk to me. That's how mad they were at Gandhi.
Yeah, they see him as the enemy. But he was very open to other faiths, I think, wasn't he? I
mean, yeah.
You would call it ecumenical in the old sense, but maybe interfaith or at least open-minded to the idea. Because truth for him was God, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, he started with saying God is truth because he was a very spiritual man. His mother was a devout Hindu in an esoteric branch of Hinduism. And then as he got deeper into his understanding, he said, truth is God. Like, we start with truth. And it starts with truth, and then nonviolence should follow. But it doesn't, as Arun Gandhi said. I came to this conclusion as well when I was at a museum in Mumbai looking at a display of early weaponry, like, you know, primitive knives, and they were used for fighting. And I just thought at the time, this idea of war goes back, you know, tribally. You know, tribalism is a hip new phrase, but I could see that man has a propensity towards conflict right up until... You know, Israel, we could talk about Israel, or I'm thinking of an essay for the New York Times, and I've assigned myself to do it this month, so it'll appear on October 2nd, in which I start this piece saying that in 1940, Gandhi wrote a letter to Hitler saying, you know, dear friend, he was such a hopeful guy, and Hitler didn't respond. He wrote 6 months later again. The war had, you know, become worse. Hitler never responded.
How would he respond to a brown guy to begin with, right?
That and from around the other side of the world. It just makes me think that this goes on. I don't know how we can solve. I don't know how we can solve the war in the Middle East. I don't know how we can solve the war in Ukraine.
Not even to mention what's going on in Sudan and so many other parts of the world.
Right.
We don't even necessarily have much of a sense from the media of what is going on. But there is another area where I find Gandhi enduring and lasting. And I mean, he identified with marginalized people. He identified with people who suffered, identified with the indigent and the poor, and said, in fact, I think your first quote in your book in chapter one is looking religiously at those who understand suffering. And that was really a kind of centerpiece of Gandhi ideology and Gandhi faith, really, and belief.
Yes.
Putting aside all the hope, maybe, that he shouldn't have had. And yet, you were... fortunate enough, smart enough, ingenious enough, whatever, to get a foreword by the Dalai Lama, no less. I have to ask you a question about him, but we'll get to that maybe.
Let's get to that.
But there's a whole sense of his identification as the Dalai Lama, his holiness, the Dalai Lama, his identification with Gandhi for his compassion, for his recognition of suffering. And on that level, there is really much to learn from Gandhi and much that clearly you wanted to learn and wanted to communicate.
Yes, yes, yes. Getting His Holiness the Dalai Lama to write the foreword was a real coup, and my publisher said, oh, this is a game changer. But he and his committee read the book before they wrote the foreword, and they had two queries that they asked me to change, which is interesting that I don't mention in my book. One of them had to do with me talking about religious violence. And as you said wisely, His Holiness doesn't want to promote religious violence, but we know most of the wars in the world are at base religious wars. So, you know, I took a moment and, you know, should I go with lose the opportunity to have the foreword from His Holiness or cut one paragraph? And I felt like, in total, I had covered what I had wanted to say. But
it was a tough editorial choice, though, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I did some soul searching, and maybe I sold out.
Well, as long as you kept your morality. But, sometimes I look at the Dalai Lama, and I think he should feel very aggressive and angry and violent toward China. I mean, that would be a human way to feel, understandably, with what he's been through and what his people have been through, what his tribe has been through. But it's not. Do you understand, by the way, this is a bit of a sidebar to be sure, but what was that thing with the kid and the tongue? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do.
I mean, I don't want to in any way insult the Dalai Lama, who I have immense respect for, but I've never understood that.
I'm glad you brought it up. And I talked to people.
You should explain what it was.
Yeah, there was an incident where a young kid, looked like a young boy, maybe 6 or 8, came to the Dalai Lama, and they were face-to-face in a meeting. And the Dalai Lama said something like an approach to kiss him, lick his tongue. And I looked at the video, whatever they had, they did not actually touch lips. It's like a saying. It's like a gesture, a cultural gesture that has no prurient implications.
No, the media picked up on it as, the Dalai Lama wanted a French kiss a kid. That's pedophilia.
Yeah. I talked to Dan Goleman. He's an old friend of mine, author of Emotional Intelligence and in the Inner Circle of the Dalai Lama with their Mind Life Institute. He said the media jumped on it, as you said, to suggest something, wrong going on. But they didn't touch tongues. And it's like if you said, give me a high five. In some cultures, that might be, a violent act, where here it's like, give me a high five. That's what happened there. And at the time, just another inside story, when we were finishing this book and we got His Holiness to sign on, that incident happened, and my editor right away said, what should we do? And that's when I called all my friends closer to the Dalai Lama, and they said, this will blow over. He's bigger. This is, bigger than that. And it sort of settled out. And
I have smart friends. I didn't know if it would settle down because the way the media was playing it up. But
how did you feel?
They're right. It did. It did seem to settle down.
Yeah.
I think what I'm really, as a reader of your book, and hearing you talk about this whole quest you were on, an odyssey really, you wanted to learn how to be good, right?
Yes.
I was very influenced by Sal Bellow as a writer, and he said, he was always raising this question, how should a good man live?
Saw that.
A very important question, even at this stage of life, as Perry opening up my book.
So we're referring to one of Michael's early books called Off Mic, A Memoir of Talk Radio and Literary Life, and I had read it a few weeks ago. At the very second paragraph, Michael says of Bellow, how should a good man live? And I tagged it and posted it because that resonated with what I was looking for.
It's something about growing up in our generation as Jewish Americans. It's tied, it seems to me, to that desire and that ethos of trying to find it. When Gandhi says truth and love will always be victorious, and when he talks about utopia and so forth, and even when he talks about faith, I also wrote a book called Spiritual Envy about feeling envious toward people who have faith. I find that Gandhi doesn't necessarily work for me the way I would like him to work. But when he talks about human suffering and identifying with it and understanding it and having compassion and empathy and so forth, he reaches me. And
yes,
that's a sense of goodness. You know, you're recognizing the evil and you're trying to deal with the evil by essentially aligning yourself with good.
One of my spiritual teachers was Ram Dass, who I hope your listeners know.
He's a friend of mine, yes.
Yes, because he lived in Marin for some years, and he was a teacher of mine since the mid-70s. I quote him here, Ram Dass would talk about the pickpocket who became a saint, the pickpocket who picked the pockets of saints to the point where eventually he took on the ethical traits of these saints. This is how I thought maybe of myself. If I try to emulate Gandhi's principles, it would lift me.
You would absorb some of Gandhi. There's a book by Jean Genet, the playwright and famous French thinker, called Saint. There's a book about him called Saint Genet by Jean-Paul Sartre, and it's about how, actually goes back to American literature and Hawthorne's idea of the negative path. If you steal and rob and do these kinds of things, and then you reform, you become more of an embodiment of goodness than if you just go to goodness without understanding the negativity or the other side of things. In fact, I was thinking in reading your book about, you write about some woman saying maybe you were doing some cultural appropriation, you know, yes, writing about Gandhi. Yes. It's always going to be that kind of thing. But I was thinking about the American tradition that is really tied to, it's very different than obviously the East. By the East, I don't mean New York, I mean India. but it's nevertheless anchored in the idea of seeking truth and seeking goodness. I mean, Thoreau, for example, was really a kind of Gandhian thinker in so many ways. He believed in nonviolence and he believed in passive resistance. And you can really trace a line from Thoreau to Lincoln to, I suppose, even Barack Obama, Martin Luther King. Right?
The Dalai Lama. Gandhi read a lot of Thoreau, and some believe that his ideas about passive resistance, nonviolent protest, comes from Thoreau. You talk about empathy, I just want to read the first two sentences of my book, because this is what, you know, people say, what did you learn from this? So here is the beginning of the book. I cry more often now, frequently triggered by the gravity of the human condition. But I also laugh more, often triggered by the inherent humor in the human condition. I feel more. I empathize more. And then I go into what Gandhi had written about empathy. It's the kind of, it's a keystone, I think, of trying to live a moral life. You know, walk a mile in my shoes is how we might put it today.
There is a danger in empathy, though, too. I mean, you can feel empathy to such a depth and realize your own insufficiency and impotence and inability to ameliorate it or reduce it or do anything about it. And then if you start feeling, I used to warn my students, for example, not to internalize too much the suffering that they read in some of the poets that I used to teach, particularly people like Sylvia Plath. I mean, you can internalize that and wind up going haywire within your own viscera, you know, because of the insufficiency in terms of what you're capable of doing, but also because, as Wordsworth said, the world is too much with us, you know.
Yes, yes.
I'm quoting him more often these days.
For me, it comes down to what is the difference between sympathy and empathy. And I understand that nurses have to learn the difference, because if they feel too much the pain of the patient, they lose their objectivity. So, you know, can you be empathic without being sympathetic?
Or can you be empathic with just, there's another school shooting recently, just horrible. four people yes. died, two teachers and two students, and the sheer idiocy of this. The father gives the son a rifle, and the son goes and kills people randomly, it seems. And, you know, there's all this heartbreak. These people all have families, they all have loved ones, and what can be done, or what should be done in terms of that empathy? You reach out and you feel empathy and sympathy and commiseration, and maybe put yourself in there, and you're impotent. You're hope. It's hope. It's hopeless in many ways.
Right, right. You know, I came from the generation that coined the phrase, the personal is political and the political is personal. And in my book, I decided to personalize these six principles. And at the end of each chapter, I have a little sort of tongue-in-cheek section that says, how to Gandhi truthfully, how to Gandhi nonviolently. And I, you know, had an exercise where in each of these six disciplines, I tried to think practically, what can I do? You know, simplicity was one of them. What can I do to minimize my footprint on the planet?
Well, simplicity seemed to mean to you overspending, or you brought in the Brits and the way they made their clothes and stuff, the way Gandhi hurt their economy.
Right, right. And that was one of them ways Gandhi wanted to go back to the crafts, you know, handcrafts. But I also stopped buying things. I called a moratorium on buying anything new that was not food. I emptied out my closet and gave it away to Goodwill. You know, there are things you can do, but also the simple.
You're going to hurt Jeff Bezos with this, you know. You want people to do this. Amazon will be affected by it. But
Elon Musk might not be going to the moon if he had been a little more simple. Michael, I also internalize it in my mind. How can I simplify my mind? And this little device I'm holding in my hand is a phone. They call it a smartphone, but the smartphones dumb us down, because how many times last night I couldn't remember something, so I tapped and said, ask Siri or whoever lives inside my
Google's phone. Made Us Stupid is the title of a book, I think.
That should be. You're working on that one?
No, not my book. It's a book that's out there. It's extant. Oh. But you talk about, you know, how you were influenced and realized your own roots and all this. I mean, it was interesting to read you writing about being a meat and potatoes guy, you know, because, I mean, that was certainly the way I was raised, too. It's very, like I said earlier, it's very hard for me to be a vegetarian or to give up meat, even though I would like to, just in principle. And yet, you know, I think about our ancestors who desperately wanted to have the kind of meals that we can afford or we can avail ourselves of. We can just go to a soup kitchen and eat, you know, a much better meal than a lot of our ancestors did. And so, you know, we have to put these things sometimes in a perspective. I do.
The perspective I put them in is, well, for one thing, I want to cop to the fact that I was vegetarian for a year, and then I let fish slip in. So now...
Oh, you're pescatarian now.
Publicly claiming pescatarianism. But I also realize that the social construct around meat, steak, filet mignon, is exactly that. You know, we wrap this food with ideas that that's the good life and that we can afford it. And I remember the last time I ate meat before I went on the vegetarian trip, I had a filet mignon at a, what is it called, Chris's?
Ruth Chris, yeah.
Ruth Chris's steak.
Good plug for them, yeah.
Hello. I took three bites, and I was really looking forward to this because my dad was a meat and potatoes man. And after three bites, I just realized it's like chewing leather. It didn't feel like the reward was as good as the buildup. And that helped me let go of it.
Was it pink or was it well done?
A medium rare. I dated a woman who was a chef, and she called bacon the gateway to meat.
Gateway to cardiac arrest, too,
exactly.
Among other things.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, all this makes sense for health and everything. But, you know, there's a kind of asceticism that you're elevating here. Do you think asceticism, that is denying... I'm not saying you have to be a hedonist. Those are the two polarities. But asceticism can mean, you know, denying your appetites. And is that necessarily a good thing?
Well, I came to the conclusion that tapering down was the key to elimination. And it didn't matter if you eliminated any of these things, you taper down. So if you were violent 90% of the time, if you reduce that to 30% of the time, that's a step in the right direction. And I want to remind you that the subtitle of my book was Try to Live Moral Truths in Immoral Times. So, you know, it's like the salmon swimming upstream against the tide of, you know, human nature.
When were there moral times? Remember some moral times? No, I mean, you know, we can be very romantic and almost Pollyanna-ish about...
Exactly.
We were very fortunate. We grew up in a time when, you know, we didn't have all this Sturm und Drang that we have now, or this kind of polarization and enmity in politics and all this sort of things. But I'm not sure we ever lived in moral times.
Well, our fathers, we're approximately the same age, but you are my elder a bit.
They were the best generation, as Tom Brokaw said.
Yeah, exactly. But our fathers had been, you know, served in the war in some capacity, or the war was this dark cloud, World War II. And I know my father, I could feel, I could almost feel the shrapnel in his psychology. He lived a modest life.
Was he wounded in World War II then?
He was not wounded, literally, but I think emotionally he was wounded. And he wasn't on the front, but being in the military, which I did not experience, put him and also he was born in 1920. So when he was 9 or 10, we had a Great Depression, a crash, and luckily his father kept a job and had a job. But I think that's why that generation lived more conservatively. Better safe than sorry. Don't take chances. Don't gamble on to become a writer. You know, I majored in economics because I thought that's what my Jewish father would want of me. Turned out I went on probation as an econ major.
Yeah, but the dismal science was not for you.
I digress.
But you made a nice step and pivot into journalism and have had some success there, which is something to be proud of. I wanted to ask you, though.
Thanks.
Did you read Joe Lilienfeld's book on Gandhi?
Yes.
Because I remember interviewing him. I knew and admired his father, who was a rabbi. And,
right, you told me this.
Got beat up in the South protesting integration, in favor of integration, and try to do essentially what Cheney and Goodman and tried to do. They tried to register voters, you know, who were black and so forth.
Hmm.
But he was also the editor of the New York Times, and he was someone who really, at the time, wrote, it seemed to me, a pretty good book about Gandhi. Yeah?
It was thick, it was tiresome, and it was exhaustingly well-researched. He was very good. But when I read it, it helped me decide how to write my book because I felt this arm's length distance. He was an academician. He was a journalist. I didn't feel him in the mode of Gandhi. And that's very understandable. There are hundreds of books about Gandhi. It was daunting for me to think about taking this on. So I took, let's call it the Perry 2.0 approach, which I personalized it. But Lilienfeld was brilliant, I conceded. And his book was exhaustingly well-researched, and I drew a lot from it and, again, diverted from it. But you remind me of something else I want to bring up, because you grew up in Cleveland. If I said Skokie, Illinois, what's the first thing that comes to mind to you?
Well, the Nazi march, of course, but... In fact, a friend of mine, Blair Gershko, was involved in a film about Skokie, which I still think is about that whole unrest and what happened. I still think it's probably the best film that's been done about that.
Part of my research was to find pockets of Indians living in the U.S. and also in England, and Skokie came up as one of the highest populated cities with Indian population. So I went there. And none of this appears in my book, but I spent 3 or 4 days in Skokie where, as you say, there were the freedom of speech movement won and Nazis could walk in the streets. And there were Skokie was a very Jewish suburb of Illinois.
A high number of Holocaust survivors.
Exactly. There's a museum there supported by them. Skokie is a suburb of Chicago. And now it's highly populated with Indians, and there's a Gandhi statue, and the Jews and the Indians have found a harmonious community. Skokie bills itself as the most diverse and harmonious city in the country. So that's a sign that maybe there's a little bit of change going on.
Also sounds like a wonderful setup for a joke of a book on Jewish humor a few years ago, and those setups with two different nationalities or ethnicities often begin that way. let's talk about passive resistance, though, and I mean, that's really a keystone to understanding Gandhi and his legacy and really what he's all about and why he's had such an impact and continues to have an impact. There is absolutely no doubt, it's incontrovertible, a real power in passive resistance. It can move things in ways that, certainly the Brits didn't expect to meet that kind of thwarting of their needs and their colonialism, and it really had an immense effect of change.
It had an amazing effect on Martin Luther King. King took the Gandhi's playbook in the South.
Exactly what I was going to say. So, I mean, we see historically the importance of passive resistance, and yet one wonders, in this post-Trump world that we live in now, especially, or in a world where there's new alignments like China, Russia, and Iran, and North Korea is really sort of a new alignment, as opposed to, I don't know what's going to happen if Trump is reelected. Maybe he'll continue his love affair with Kim Jong-un and want to build a new tower in Moscow and continue to cozy up to Putin. I don't know. I can't predict these things. Geopolitics is one of those impossible areas to even have any kind of prescience with. But the world now seems to be, is passive resistance still a potential kind of powerful force like it once was?
Well, let's look at the Occupy movement. It started as a sit-in, which is what, you know, in the 60s, the students had sit-ins and be-ins, and it was a kind of form of protest without aggression. The Occupy movement started that way on the Wall Street area, but it grew, and then it devolved. Ultimately,
and then it disappeared.
It disappeared, had no impact. I remember following it for a while, thinking, oh, this relates to what I want to write about, but I couldn't find people who would speak to it well. And, what I saw was confrontations between the police and the Occupy movement, and they either dispersed people or there was eventually violence. I don't think of any examples where passive resistance as a mass movement has any impact. There are people we can point to. You remember Dick Gregory?
I interviewed him a couple times, in fact.
He went on long fasts. We should say that one of Gandhi's ways of passive resistance was to go on a fast.
Not healthy in the long run.
Not healthy. And did it impact? Well, according to the Attenborough film, yes. Some would say historically that's not exactly accurate. And by the way, I went to some of the places in the Attenborough film to see how with the accuracy, and it's a Hollywood film. They, play with location, they play with timelines. So, and also just to add, I was amazed at how many people I interviewed, even in India, when I asked, what do you know about Gandhi? They would say, I saw the film. But there's little evidence that nonviolent protest has any effect now.
Well, we're in a world of social media. We're in a world of technology that had never even crossed the threshold of being conceived. And so things have changed in a quantum and almost immeasurable way. And I don't know, it would be interesting to see how passive resistance might work.
Do you think that the there are boycotts, which economic boycotts and trade boyccotts, that's what could be imagined as a passive way to push people?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they have impact. No question. Iran has been hurt. Is a good example. Comes right to mind by
China also.
Well, by the boycotts. I mean.
Yes. Okay.
They're more aligned with China now, like I said, than they ever were before. But so what's listen, we have a few minutes left here. Gandhi's main legacy, according to Perry Garfinkel, in this book and this whole quest of yours. So what does it come down to?
Well, the main, you know, pillars of Gandhi's philosophy were truth and nonviolence. Given that we do live in immoral times, and, you know, maybe all times are immoral, but it seems like right now it's up. It's like a question, where are we going? And the upcoming elections are going to, you know, be a measure of which direction we're going in.
Each side sees the other as immoral, by the way. That's almost a given.
Yeah. That's a riot. I think that Gandhi's legacy is to remember him and try to do things that would alleviate world violence, encourage peace and truth. Truth is,
truth is multivalent, as I like to say.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
I mean, there are many truths, and depending on who has the truth or believes they hold the truth.
What I learned from Buddhism was that truth is ever-changing. So if I say truth right now it's the different truth, you know, in 5 seconds from now. Gandhi also, and I tried to dissect in my book absolute truth, relative truth, subjective truth, objective truth. There are gradations, as you used that big word before, of truth. So I think my lesson and my lesson to the world is consider this all. And when you consider it, I think you would move in the direction that we would hope would bring greater mutual understanding, world peace. You know, those jokes like everybody's praying for world peace. And I think it made me a bit Pollyanna-ish. I'm a cynic by profession as a journalist. And maybe being Jewish, we look for the humor comes out of seeing the dark side and making fun of it. But I come away feeling heartened, and only personally, that I've changed. And I'm a pretty stubborn guy. And as you've noted in the beginning of the book, I was doing some pretty decadent things. But look at me now.
No decadence, huh? Well, you still got the Pollyanna in you, that's for sure, and idealism. And congratulations to you on this book.
Thank you.
I can't help but think of a little anecdote. Julian Guthrie, who is a friend of mine whom you may know, many years wrote for the San Francisco Chronicle, was kind of the it girl back in the day. So she wrote a book about Larry Ellison, and she told me a story about Larry Ellison and Steve Jobs. They said, "Who, if you could be anybody living or dead?" Jobs immediately said, "Gandhi." You know, he revered Gandhi and looked up to Gandhi, and in many ways tried to live a very simple life. I asked Walter Isaacson, his biographer, did Steve give any money to any charities or anything, or was it mainly his wife who gave the money? And Isaacson, who knew all about his sex life and his love life, and didn't really know the answer to that. Was he penurious and trying to be like Gandhi, or did he just not believe in philanthropy and charity to others? I know that's kind of cloaked in mystery, but he wanted to be. Guess who Larry Ellison said he wanted to be?
Gandhi.
No, not Gandhi.
Oh, not Gandhi.
No, it was just Jobs. Larry Ellison said Napoleon. I always liked that. I was quite amused by that. Those are like Rorschachs for those. So would you be Gandhi or would you be Buddha? Who would you be?
I'm trying to be Perry.
Good answer.
And as I said, as I joked before, Perry 2.0. I think I've learned that the gerundial form of Perry, that if we're always striving to improve ourselves in each of these six categories, that's a step forward.
So you've moved forward.
Moving forward.
You don't have to be self-congratulatory about that. I'll congratulate you on that.
Thank you.
Just stay forward. Keep moving forward. That's my advice. The book, again, is Becoming Gandhi, My Experiment, Living the Mahatma, Six Moral Truths in Immoral Times by Perry Garfinkel, author of national bestseller, Buddha or Bust. Really good talking.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank all of you who joined us for this episode and remind you Gray Matter with Michael Krasny can be heard live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time or on Apple, Spotify, or simply by going to our website at graymatter.show. And if you haven't yet become a member of the podcast, I invite you to join by going to the website. Again, that's graymatter.show. And you can find previous episodes of Gray Matter with Michael Krasny there, Gray with an E. Also invite you to mail any reactions or suggestions you might have to me at mkrasny@graymatter.show. I want to thank our whole team, Alex, Shannon, Chad, Kevin, Colin, Jeff, Colleen, and Tanya. And special thanks again to our guest this week, Perry Garfinkel. I'm Michael Krasny.
Bandwidth for Gray Matter is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.